Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent.
You're listening to HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is attorney Matt Todaro, a partner in the Environmental and Land Use Practice Group at Verrill. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Tani.
It's so great to have you here. And I'm guessing a lot of our listeners haven't worked with you specifically because A, it's our hope that most of you don't have to deal with attorneys very often, and B, that you don't need to work with somebody whose practice area is specifically related to OSHA and all of the ins and outs of that statute and the regulatory issues that follow that statute. So, Matt, your practice area is pretty diverse. It's not just OSHA. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what it is that you do?
Sure, Tani. I think that, in general, my practice deals with hazardous materials. And hazardous materials may involve hazardous materials at your workplace, designing a health and safety plan to handle those hazardous materials, perhaps designing a product that involves hazardous materials or is made through hazardous materials. I also do a lot of work with hazardous materials when they're no longer useful products, but when hazardous materials may wind up in the ground. How you deal with a situation where you're remediating hazardous materials, or what happens if hazardous materials wind up in groundwater. So hazardous materials is the basis. Hopefully it is when they're being used in a productive, positive way, protecting employees from hazardous materials, using them to design and build things, but also when things go wrong with hazardous materials.
I feel like there are such a large host of jokes that we could make about the fact that your practice is primarily devoted to hazardous materials and the people that you work with on a daily basis and on and on and on and on. But it's probably not the time or place for any of those jokes.
I have had clients say to me, my name is Matt. It's also spelled with one T. Oh, you're Hazmat. You should get a license plate that says that. I have refrained from doing that because, yes, I'm not sure it's the greatest joke, but yeah, that is a line of jokes that could be used.
I'm all for puns, so I think that one's pretty fun, and clearly I'm laughing about it already. So you're a partner at Verrill, correct? And is this your first career? Did you do something before you started being an attorney? What made you decide to work all day, every day with hazardous materials?
Very good question. I guess you could call this sort of my second career. Prior to going to law school, I worked in Washington, D.C. for a number of years doing environmental policy, focusing specifically on the issue about international climate change, but really the environment as a whole. So when I went to law school, I knew that that was a focus that I'd like to take. And I think that work in the policy world, particularly in Washington, D.C., has helped my practice develop with a very pragmatic approach. The law and the regulations are guide what we do on a daily basis. But policy is never far out of the picture. And oftentimes, especially with OSHA, guidance documents are very critical for how you actually implement the regulations that are in the book. And I think I have an ease with working with those guidance documents. I think the pragmatic approach helps our clients because oftentimes regulations are not black and white. And a lot of the world that we live in is gray. And I think the world that I lived in D.C. for policy was certainly gray. That's really, I've taken a lot from that prior world and brought it to my current practice.
I think the interesting aspect of a lot of this as well is that every regulation, I feel like that a government, whether state or local or even federal, creates, I mean, the amount of gray area that is there, it is so difficult. And you have some agencies within state or federal government that say, well, unless the statute or unless the regulations specifically provide that you can do it, then you can't do it. And then you have other agencies that take the position, well, unless the regulations specifically prohibit it, then you can do it. And having the background kind of knowledge and experience about the regulations themselves and how the agencies interpret them and what their guidance letters say as well, or their guidance interpreting their regulations, which are regulations that are interpreting the statute. I mean, you just have to keep on digging deeper and deeper. And to me, that's one of the reasons why it's so important that when we're dealing with something that is as highly regulated as hazardous materials generally, having somebody who has experience in the field and specifically in this field is so important. I presume this isn't something that you would recommend a company or anyone working kind of in the industry or working with hazardous materials goes to a general practitioner and says, hey, I've got this letter from OSHA. What should I do now?
I think that's right. This is, you know, workplace safety is never simple. The hazards that employers deal with are almost always complex. And if they don't think they're complex, then I often caution employers to step back because there's a lot of hazards that folks who see them every single day don't always see. For example, I was working with an employer who I specifically asked whether or not they had a fall safety program. And they said, no, we don't have a fall safety program because we don't work from heights. Our employers are always working on the ground. There's an enormous body of regulations that come with working above a 4-foot surface for OSHA. And then I said, well, there's a forklift in the corner. Does anyone use that? They said, no, we don't use that. I said, okay, well, there's also a cage on that forklift that looks like somebody would use that to elevate employees. And I said, no, again, confirmed and clarified, we don't work from heights. And I said, what happens in this facility, this was a large warehouse, when a light bulb goes out on your working floor? And they said, oh, so-and-so from the maintenance department gets in the forklift, uses the lift, and changes the bulb. And I said, do they use a fall arrest system? And they said, no, it's just for changing bulbs. And I said, if OSHA walked in the door tomorrow, they would cite you for not having a fall hazard program because you've got individuals working from elevated heights. I think examples like that we see often in a workplace where an employer, because it's just what they live and see and do every single day, they often don't see the most obvious things. So if you are just a general practitioner, not having the experience of walking into workplaces and seeing things like a forklift sitting on the side, or another example, lockout tagout, complex program that requires training. It's not always the most intuitive for employers or employees. Another situation, who works on your machines? Do you always bring in an outside vendor? No, so-and-so has been at the facility for 35 years. They know each one of these machines inside and out. They could take them apart, put them all back together. If anything breaks, he or she is always the person on the job. Do they have lockout tagout training? No, because they know the machines inside and out. Well, of course, knowing machines inside and out, being able to take them apart inside and out with your eyes closed, doesn't prevent you from electrical hazards. So you need to have that electrical HAZCOM program as well. So a lot of aspects to this type of practice that I just don't, I would caution the general practitioner from just diving in, because there's a lot to not know.
Well, I think kind of with that setup, I think let's get into the topic for today. And our topic today is the top 5 critical OSHA mistakes that employers make. I mean, we just started talking about some aspects, or I'd say specifically, some very specific aspects of issues and concerns that people have, that companies are going to have. And this isn't just manufacturing. Like, if you're changing a light bulb and someone's above 4 feet, then they need some type of fall protection. And that's whether it's in an office, if you have cathedral ceilings, whatever it is, you're going to need to have these type of safety requirements in place. So let's get into it. What's the first critical OSHA mistake that employers make?
The first, and in no particular order, but I like to start with this mistake because I think it helps employers understand that it's key to have a prospective look at health and safety as opposed to a retrospective look. If you don't have a health and safety plan, a comprehensive plan that analyzes the hazard, whether they're big hazards in a manufacturing location or small hazards, perhaps in an office setting or an office setting that may have light manufacturing, if you don't have that comprehensive plan, then you really probably need to push pause, because that plan is really your constitution. It's the document that pulls together all of the elements of your program, helps ensure both that your employees are safe at the work site, but also that you as an employer are protected. Oftentimes we go into a situation where an employer says, you know, we've got a lot of standard operating procedures for all of the work that's done here. You know, these standard operating procedures have been developed for the past 15 years. We know we have all the critical steps included in them. Standard operating procedures are great for an individual who is doing a very particular job. But if those are not woven into an overall program that has looked at the hazards that are associated with each one of those standard operating procedures, you're missing something.
And I would presume that most standard operating procedures, initially, if you haven't been thinking from an OSHA standpoint, are focusing on efficiency and effectiveness for operating in the most cost-effective manner and creating a product that meets the specifications that have been previously set forth. But unless you have a safety inspector or someone whose job is specifically to look at the safety aspect of the manufacturing or the creating or the operation itself, I'd presume that that's often missing. Is that what you find often?
It is. A challenge for employers often is that they don't always have someone in this role. So safety often falls to HR, and there's someone there or maybe a team of people that look at it in a worst case scenario right after an accident happens. In a best case scenario, perhaps intermittently with all the other things that they're juggling, benefits, 401k, all things like that, and then safety gets lumped in on the side. If there aren't the resources to have a dedicated safety individual, my recommendation always is at some point, find the time, find the resources to bring in an outside consultant. Set up a comprehensive program that can operate, that the HR department can actually operate, but make sure that framework is in place. And things that I'm talking about in terms of your health and safety framework would include who from the management team weighs in on safety, who from your employee team weighs in on safety. There should be some tiered structure set to your program. Also part of that program should be, how is safety talked about? When is safety talked about? Do you have a daily toolbox talk? Do you have a weekly safety meeting? When your president, CEO, whoever it is, addresses to the staff, do they have a safety minute in that address every time they address the staff? Or perhaps do they lead with that safety minute because it's a culture that you're trying to build at your workplace, that above all else, we want to make sure that everybody who walks into this facility at the beginning of the day walks out in the same exact condition. Another piece that is key to build into your safety program that the comprehensive program allows you to do is, this should be a part of your onboarding process as HR. HR, you're handing a lot of documents out to your employees when they walk in the door. You should also be handing them your health and safety manual for a couple of reasons. Number one, it helps build that culture. It says on day one, we're not just concerned about turning out widgets as quickly as we can in the most cost-effective way as we can. We're concerned about your safety. So day one, you get that health and safety manual. It says this is a priority here. The other piece from an employer's standpoint that's critical is the last page of that health and safety manual should be a certification that says, new employee, I've read this manual. I understand what this manual says. I understand the consequences of not following what the manual says. Sign it, put it in the employee's file. It helps an employer defend against a case at some point, someday, if an employee says, you know, I got hurt in the job. I was never informed of what the risks were. There was not an adequate plan in place. Go to the file. You have that certification. It's the first step in defending against a claim.
In my mind, one of the biggest concerns that I often have with a client is if I watch an owner or a executive manager walk onto the floor and not take either hearing protection out of the box next to the door or put eye protection on as they walk in. So if you are a human resources employee or manager and you're watching executives or owners who are walking onto your plant, and not following those precautions, is there a way in which the HR manager can communicate with ownership what kind of fines or what kind of issues could occur as a result of them literally just walking out onto the floor? Because while culture starts at the top in all aspects, from safety, from interpersonal relationships, all of those things. But I talk to a lot of human resources managers who will say, unless I can prove the financial importance of this, I'm not going to get time to put towards making a safety manual. And we are an operation that is, we have to look in the past. So it's after an accident occurs that I'm looking at it, but we don't have time or energy to look prospectively as to best ways to take care of these issues. And anyways, we have workers' comp. So what does it really matter? If someone does get injured, we're going to be fine. I just gave a long, long rambling question, but I want to divide that up into multiple segments, but I want to do it after we return from a really quick break. So I'm Tani Alvarez. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobsinme.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobsinme to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
I'm Chris Riccobono, founder of Untuckit. We started Untuckit because we couldn't find shirts that look good untucked. That's why we created the perfect untucked shirt so guys can look sharp and feel casual. Untuckit shirts fall at just the right length. We have 50 fit combinations, so tall, short, slim, and bigger guys of all ages can look great in Untuckit shirts. Try the original Untuckit shirt at one of our 55 Untuckit stores or at Untuckit.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. Our guest today is Matt Todaro from Verrill, and we're talking about the top five critical OSHA mistakes employers make. Before the break, I went on a long-winded tangent about the importance of having and making sure that safety is a priority from the top. And one of the examples I gave is when I walk into a company and senior executives or owners walk out onto the shop floor and they don't have hearing protection or any type of protection, whatever personal protective device is necessary isn't being worn. Human resources often knows what's supposed to be happening and wants to speak up, but how are they, what are some resources that they can use to help owners and managers understand how truly important this is? Normally, that's with a financial figure. I mean, what kind of financial numbers are we looking at? Are we looking at a $200 slap on the wrist, or is it something greater than that?
It's certainly a figure that's north of $200. Each year, or nearly each year, OSHA increases the amounts that their penalties are handed out at. We haven't seen the 2020 figures yet, but for 2019, you're talking about, for a violation that's less than serious, approximately $13,000, which... whether you're a large company or a small company, that's real money. That's significant money. And of course, OSHA sets those figures at a level in which they know will inflict some pain and will also create some deterrence. Because when OSHA is inspecting one facility, they know that their press release about that inspection, they're hoping that their press release about that inspection will impact a separate facility. But, you know, we can talk and OSHA has tiered penalties. Their less than serious penalty will be around $13,000. Serious penalties will increase from there. If you're talking about repeat violations, now you're talking about six figures. If you're talking about willful violations, you're talking about figures that increase in the six figures very quickly. So the culture that you develop from the top to the bottom is incredibly critical. I was recently settling an OSHA matter where the client had a very comprehensive health and safety program in place. They rolled it out to new employees. They trained their new employees. But on a hot August day, an individual decided their standard procedure was to always wear personal protective equipment from head to toe when unloading sulfuric acid from a rail car. But it was a hot day. They went up on that rail car. They should have been using a buddy system. Crunch for time. This individual went up by themselves, opened the wrong valve on the top of the rail car. Instead of releasing the sulfuric acid into the hose that ran into the staging tank, they released the sulfuric acid onto themselves. They came down as quick as they could off of that rail car, ran to the closest shower, and then wound up going to the hospital with some severe burns. And OSHA came in, of course, immediately, and our client presented OSHA with their health and safety plan, with the training records for that individual. And we ultimately said, look, this was an individual's poor decision, poor judgment on their part to not wear PPE. They'd been trained. They knew that this was a system that was in place. And OSHA said, we think it's more than that. We think that there's a culture here of not enforcing your health and safety program. Please show us, demonstrate to us that employees have been cited in the past for not wearing PPE. The client couldn't present that. Show us records of where your safety talks are speaking specifically about PPE for the rail car. And we couldn't demonstrate that either. So in the end, the best health and safety plan will only take you so far when an incident happens. It's really that culture that starts from the top that saves you large amounts of money in the end that can prevent an accident.
And this seems to go not just from a safety standpoint, so health and well-being, right? But you mentioned earlier that OSHA will do a press release. So if OSHA is doing a press release that includes the employer's name, we all know how difficult it is from a recruiting and retention standpoint right now. If you have a candidate who is someone who you want, who you're seeking, who you've sought after, and this is your perfect person, and they Google you or use whatever other search device they choose to use on a daily basis and find out that you've got these OSHA violations, it's not going to be in your company's best interest.
Sure. And customers will read that press release as well. And folks want to deal with companies that they think are doing the right thing. So it can hurt your bottom line in a number of different ways.
So we've got our first critical OSHA mistake employers make. Let's move on to the second. What's the second critical OSHA mistake that employers make in no particular order?
Well, let's start the second one with a question. Tawny, what do you think that the single most frequent reason that OSHA visits an employer's site is?
An accident.
An accident, although they happen, that is the most likely trigger, it is not the most frequent trigger.
Okay, so tell me what the most frequent trigger is.
The most frequent trigger is an employee complaint. Most frequently, OSHA is on site because an employee picks up the phone or sends an email and says, there is something going on at the place that I work that I am uncomfortable with. There's something that is happening that I think is unsafe for either me or for other employees at this site. And OSHA, I think you need to come and take a look at this. So the number two reason, or number two way that employers get in trouble with OSHA is not creating some sort of system for employees to report that internally before they feel the need to report it externally.
Now, if a company just has a general whistleblower policy, I mean, I'm surprised that I didn't get that answer right, because we all know so much of my practice is taken up with dealing with employee complaints. It sounds like it remains super important that we deal with employee complaints regarding safety issues. But do you suggest lumping this in with your general whistleblower policy, or should we be looking at a very specific safety and health or OSHA whistleblower policy or just OSHA reporting policy?
There are a couple different types of OSHA reporting requirements. If you have a serious injury, if you have a head injury, you have a concussion, you have loss of an eye, loss of a limb, there are reporting requirements by statute and regulation that you need to report those things immediately to OSHA. Thankfully, those are infrequent and more rare. What you really want to try and capture here, and I think you raise a good point, which is it should be a separate system from your general whistleblower system, is near misses. Because often near misses are really the keys to show you where you may have hazards in your workplace. And if the near miss system is something that people are using frequently, it can be done anonymously, and they feel like that is a good tool for reporting safety concerns, then you will avoid that situation where an employee feels like they are not being heard. Near misses can be as simple as just a box with a notepad next to it. I'm also seeing technology being used for this. There are apps now that allow you to create a near miss system on your phone. Most employees have phones these days. You write it down, send it in, it creates an electronic log, the employer sees it, and it's saved internally for the employer to reference at any point. So a lot of different ways you can do it, but my recommendation always is this is a separate system to provide more emphasis on the need for employees to report internally.
And I think this is helpful because it ties in a little bit with the first common mistake that we discussed, right? Because if you were listening and you heard about the first common mistake as being kind of lack of a safety program, this seems like it's a part of that. And if you were saying, well, I don't even know where to begin, Matt's just given you some very helpful advice or tools as to a potential place to begin with kind of near miss looks and creating a policy that focuses on reporting, but in doing so, knowing what you're going to do once that report is made. So we've got one and two. What is the third most critical mistake that employers often make with regards to OSHA?
This is a mistake that I think is really the overly Band-Aid approach. You see employers often saying, okay, I know that we've got some hazards at the facility. I know we need to provide PPE for personal protective equipment for our employees to keep them safe. So let's make sure we've got a robust and strong respiratory program where we're getting everyone medically tested for respirators. We're making sure everyone knows how to do fit tests, both on an annual basis and every time they use that respirator. Great, we've checked that box. Let's make sure that everybody has hearing protection because we know that we've got office space that adjoins our manufacturing location, and sometimes it gets pretty loud in there for even people who are not working on the floor. And OSHA comes in and looks at those things and says, okay, it's certainly good that you're protecting your employees in that way, but that's the Band-Aid. You are trying to remedy the potential harm that you see. Take a step back. Is it possible that a ventilation system in your workplace that creates more air changes per hour could mitigate the need for using respirators? Now, you might still need those respirators, but in the situation where you've got employees sitting near a manufacturing floor, should those folks working at desks next to the manufacturing floor, should the decibel level in that area be so high that they actually need ear protection, maybe you need a better baffling system off of your manufacturing floor that may be a more cost-effective solution in the short run than having claims about hearing impairment in the long run. OSHA views that as sort of being a little bit too in the weeds and not seeing the big picture, or worst case scenario, not putting the money into your facility that you should, and just trying to come up with cost-effective solutions for health and safety when the issue is much larger.
Which I think it goes back to the first topic as well, which was this concept of proactive versus retroactive. So it seems like we have an ongoing theme about proactively looking at your operations and the way in which you perform a task or you manufacture a device to figure out in what ways you can perform this process by creating the least amount of harm. And if you can't decrease the amount of harm that potentially is created as a result of it, that's when we're going to start relying on outside sources, personal protective equipment. The training has to occur hand in hand, but generally first looking at the process itself and then looking at the human aspects of it, because we know And we talk about this a lot, I think, in general employment issues. No one's perfect. So we can teach people not to make harassing comments. We can teach people to always be on their best behavior at work and what is a work-appropriate joke and a non-work-appropriate joke. But we know that people are still going to make inappropriate jokes at work. So the next best thing that we can do, right, is to make sure that we are disciplining them as a result and or teaching people skills in order to deal with that. That was an inappropriate joke. Being a third-party bystander and stepping in and saying that's not appreciated, that's not work appropriate. It seems like it's the same thing from an OSHA standpoint, but we're first looking at the process itself and making sure that we're doing everything as safely as possible. And then we're bringing in the people factor, which we know is never going to be perfect, especially when we have an owner and executive walking on the floor without personal protective equipment.
I think that's right. And I think if you have a professional on staff who can analyze the safety risks of your facility from a big picture, what is the risk of the process? That's very helpful. But if you don't have that individual on staff, bringing someone in from the outside with a fresh perspective can provide that analysis that'll allow you to say, okay, maybe we don't need hearing protection in this location. Maybe it's a baffle that we need. It's that sort of step back approach that is hard to get on a day-to-day basis if you are, you know, on the floor of this facility 12 hours a day. But if you're walking in for the first time, some of these things can be very obvious to folks who are just seeing the site for the first time.
And I'm guessing from a resource perspective, it also becomes quite difficult. But I have a feeling we might be talking about that after this next break. So you're listening to the HR Power Hour. Our guest today is Matt Todaro from Verrill. And we've been talking about the five critical OSHA mistakes employers make. We're going to take a quick break, but when you return, we're going to talk more to Matt about the processes and OSHA issues that he experiences on a daily basis. This is HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their QuickPost product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs and ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsandme.com. That's jobsandme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
We're back and you're listening to HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tawny Alvarez and today our guest is Matt Todaro from Verrill and the Environmental and Land Use Practice Group. We've been talking today about the top five critical OSHA mistakes employers make. A theme that has run through our discussion is looking at things prospectively and kind of being proactive in that sense versus reactive. It's great and wonderful for you to look at your practices after someone loses a finger or otherwise injures themselves, but it would be even better if you looked at your practices beforehand so that somebody doesn't lose a finger or otherwise injure themselves. And this is a cultural aspect of your organization. the importance of specifically making time to focus on these things. So we have talked about the top three critical OSHA mistakes employers make. Let's jump into the fourth critical mistake that employers often make. What is it, Matt?
The fourth mistake that we often see at workplaces is some aversion to or just never having undertaken an audit of your facility. Simple tool that can be very, very powerful and can save you a lot of money in the long run by pointing out mistakes that you might be making, compliance issues where you may be falling down, gaps in your programs, all of which you disclose internally first. So, of course, you avoid a situation, number one, where someone might get hurt because of a gap in compliance. And number two, if OSHA knocks on your door, they are not finding those gaps first.
I feel like when we use the term audit, so many companies kind of get really nervous, and they get really nervous for two reasons. One, audit sounds very regulatory, like it is bad and we are doing it in order to show them all the ways in which they are failing. And then the second aspect is oftentimes an employer will say, I know we're not perfect. I don't need a written report that provides evidence of the fact that we're not perfect in case I get in trouble later on. Because my buddy told me that if you do an audit, they're going to use it against you in a lawsuit. Now, for our listeners who maybe have that feeling, is that the truth, or can we perform audits that aren't going to adversely affect a company or an organization if they're later audited specifically by OSHA or experience some type of loss or injury to a person or people?
Undertaking an audit should certainly not be done lightly. They are tools that help you understand where you may have shortcomings in your health and safety program. I often call them compliance assessments because really that talks, it's a little bit more specific as to what you're trying to do. You're trying to analyze your compliance for health and safety.
I like that much better than audit, compliant assessment. So we'll start referring to it as such, a compliance assessment.
And really this is a tool that can be tailored for particular instances. So you know, your facility, if you know you have concerns in certain areas, you may just target those particular areas. So your compliance assessment may just deal with your handling of hazardous materials, but you don't need a full compliance assessment for your entire facility. But if you are going to do that compliance assessment for the entire facility, it's something you should give a lot of thought to beforehand, because as you pointed out, the results of that assessment are a powerful tool both internally for you to correct items that may be flagged as a result of the assessment, but it can also be a powerful tool for a regulator to use as sort of the roadmap for issuing citations if they walk in the door. I always recommend that if a company is going to undertake a compliance assessment, that you give strong consideration to involving outside or inside counsel to that compliance assessment. If you structure the compliance assessment as an attorney-client privilege document, you can go a long way to protecting that document from disclosure in the end. It should be done as a request to outside counsel, if you're going to involve outside counsel, to analyze compliance within your facility. Then outside counsel can engage either an outside consultant as part of their assessment, or they can use inside resources as well to perform that audit. But the results come to outside counsel. Outside counsel runs and directs the program, so it really does look like an attorney work product, similar to any other work product that an attorney would turn out. And in that situation, the results then can be privileged. They can be maintained internally, and you've at least got a very good argument that they shouldn't be disclosed to a regulatory authority.
I feel as though a lot of clients may believe that if they're not specifically working with chemicals, so if they don't specifically use some type of chemical in their manufacturing process or in their operations on a day-to-day basis, that they believe that OSHA doesn't apply, right? But earlier today, you gave an example of a warehouse and the warehouse having this forklift in the corner, right? You don't have to be working with chemicals or liquid substances in some format for OSHA to be applicable to your organization, correct?
That's absolutely correct. OSHA applies in any workplace setting. There are certain requirements that are triggered, like OSHA logs when you've got over 10 employees. But if you have one employee working at that location, there are some exceptions for family farms. But if you've got one employee, often the most simple tasks still involve OSHA regulations.
So we now know that OSHA regulations and requirements are applicable to a whole host of individuals and companies. But we also know that assessments generally can be protected by privilege. What should someone consider, however, if they are considering doing a compliance assessment? Are there resources that should be in place beforehand? What kind of time resources? Like what else should we do other than just, hey, we're going to do a compliance assessment?
There are a number of resources that should certainly be considered, but I think first and foremost, an employer has to be committed to the process. And in being committed to the process, they have to be committed to correcting any actions that are pointed out in the audit. Because as we talked about, an audit can be a great tool. Compliance assessment can be a great tool for getting your facility in tip-top shape so that you're 100% compliant with regulations. But if you receive that report and you don't act on that report, now all of a sudden you are opening yourself up to a situation where you had the information that a particular procedure, piece of equipment, whatever it might be, is potentially dangerous. And if you don't act on that, now you're talking about a situation where your regular citation may now be a willful or negligent citation, and that creates a lot more risk. So first and foremost, if you're going to undertake your compliance audit, you're going to dedicate the resources to do it, you're going to dedicate the time to do it, be certain that you are going to carry out the corrective actions that may come out of that compliance assessment, and that you set up a timeline and a gradient so that your highest priorities are addressed first and you document all of that. Because, of course, you don't need to do everything immediately, but there needs to be some sort of discrete and demonstrated calendar for putting those corrective actions in place.
And it sounds like it's important then to make sure that you have some type of accountability matrix that's made beforehand. We shouldn't be going into a compliance assessment with the understanding or belief that nothing's going to be found, but instead that there's going to be a multitude of different issues, all of which are going to have different general kind of timelines for compliance, which are going to require different levels of time, energy, resources, and understanding that, you know, the top two things we're going to make sure are completed within one quarter of when we learn of it, and the next within X, Y, and Z period, and who's going to be responsible for it. Because otherwise, I believe it's going to be just like so many other things that are on human resource managers or executives' desks, which is, I'll get to it. But because it's not right there in your face in that moment, sometimes it goes onto a back burner.
Yeah, the headlines, as you might imagine, could be pretty grim here. Is if an employer does a compliance assessment, they have information about a particular piece of equipment is dangerous, and then an employee gets hurt on that piece of equipment because this kicked around multiple desks in HR and nobody had the time or found the time to address it. It's got to be something when you take on the assessment that you know that you're going to carry it out and complete the process.
So that is our fourth critical OSHA mistake that employers make. We're going to take a quick break. You've been listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. We'll return after this message to find out the fifth critical OSHA mistake employers make.
Are you looking to hire? Stop wasting time. Jobs in ME.com has been matching Maine employers to job seekers since 1999. Job postings start at only $159 with their Quick Post product. Your employment ad can be distributed to over 75 job boards for maximum exposure. When it comes to recruiting locally, you can count on Jobs in ME to connect you with qualified candidates in this area. Visit jobsinme.com. That's jobsinme.com today. Stop searching and start hiring locally.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back. You're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill. I'm Tani Alvarez, and today our guest is Matt Todaro, a partner in the Environmental and Land Use Practice Group. We've been talking about the top five critical OSHA mistakes employers make. We've given you mistakes 1 through 4, and now we are on the fifth most critical OSHA mistake that employers make. Matt, the anticipation has been building. What is that last mistake that employers make? I'm actually laughing as I say that. The last employer. No. Let's just talk about that last critical mistake employers often make.
The last mistake that employers often make, and it is a very critical one, is failing to prepare for that OSHA inspection, assuming that it won't happen to their facility or it won't happen this year, that they're somehow off the radar. While our administrative agencies have less resources now than they probably have ever had before, they are still out on almost a daily basis inspecting facilities. For a state like Maine, we see almost 300 inspections conducted on an annual basis, which means you've got somebody out there in the field on a daily basis looking at facilities. On a national level, you've got two different jurisdictions. You've got state jurisdictions, you've got federal jurisdictions, result in probably 75,000 inspections on an annual basis. So no one should be lulled into thinking that OSHA is not out there doing what the statutes and regulations require them to do, because they certainly are.
I feel as though I can hear some employers saying, "There's only I only employ 5 people. There's no way they're coming after me." But we know, based off of critical mistake number 3, that the number of employees that you have really doesn't matter, because in most cases, or I don't want to say most, but in a large quantity of cases, they're coming as a result of an employee complaint, correct?
That's right. So you you may think that you don't have that many employees, you wouldn't be a target for OSHA, but often, most frequently, it has nothing to do with how OSHA perceives you. It's how your internal employees perceive the process.
And I'm guessing how you respond as well. So if you have employees who are being proactive, who are talking to you about their concerns, about what they view to be safety violations, maybe it's not a safety violation, but we still need to listen to that employee and hear why they don't feel safe. Why are they concerned about this process? Because honestly, if an employee doesn't feel safe in doing what they're doing, I'm guessing they're going to be more likely to have an injury. They're going to be more likely to not produce the best quality product. And generally, they're going to be focused on other aspects, which isn't getting the product produced or whatever process it is they are participating in.
That's right, Tawny. And often OSHA inspectors, the first question they will ask someone calling in a safety complaint will be, "Have you discussed this with your employer?" And often if the answer is no, the OSHA inspector will say, "Do that first and then call us back." So if you create those pathways, you create the culture that allows for that reporting up to management, and then management is receptive to that and actually takes action, then you may short circuit that entire reporting process to the administrative agency, which would result in that inspection. That's the best case scenario. But as we talked about, often there's a piece of this that's not there, especially if you don't have a comprehensive plan that has some sort of near miss or internal reporting system, and you'll have OSHA at your door. And the time to prepare for that OSHA inspection is certainly not when that knock happens. It's something that you should think very carefully about beforehand. I recommend creating an org chart. Who is going to be interacting with OSHA? Who's comfortable interacting with the regulators? Because when the knock comes, your heart rate quickens, your pulse quickens. Whenever I get calls from clients, OSHA is here. OSHA was just here. We've just been told that there'll be an inspection tomorrow. There's a level of fear that's involved with that. So you need to make sure you identify at least two employees that are comfortable interacting in that setting. Another piece that's very critical is to create a notebook, a binder, an electronic file, whatever it is that you're comfortable with that is prepared ahead of time for the inspection. Because again, if the knock is on the door, it's OSHA. You are going to need to grab something quickly that has all of the critical documents that OSHA is going to be looking for. These are going to be your 300 logs, your hazard communication program, your training records, your health and safety, your comprehensive program. If it exists, it's right there. That's the first piece that you hand to OSHA, and it will have all of these critical elements in it. And immediately you are showing to OSHA that health and safety is a priority for you. Often I hear from inspectors that within the first 1 minute of walking in the door, they can tell how the inspection is going to go. You walk in confident because you've got a binder with all the materials that you need. You hand that to the inspector. That speaks volumes right away. It will change the course of the way that your inspection is going to go. Other key things to think about in that inspection are routes through your facility that you think are the best routes to be walking with an inspector. If they are looking at your loading dock, they want to see the loading dock. Perhaps the best route to get to the loading dock is actually going outside, not a circuitous route as you're walking through the facility. Also keeping in mind that most OSHA inspections follow a typical pattern. You'll have your opening conference where they'll talk about why they're there, they'll ask for documents, and then they'll do a site walk, and then do a closing conference. Often people are very conscious about the fact that they don't want to offer too much information in that opening conference, but when you move into that site walk, folks let their guard down and they forget that when they're walking through the facility with OSHA that everything is on record. Not a good time to be talking about small talk about what happened at the facility. If it was a risky behavior, everything from the moment that they are walk in the door to the moment they leave is on record. And again, this goes back to selecting the right people to have those conversations.
Matt, these are some really great tips. Thank you so much for appearing on this episode and discussing with our listeners the top five critical OSHA mistakes that employers make. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Tawny. My pleasure.
You've been listening to HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM and WLOBradio.com. That was Matt Todaro, a partner at Verrill's Environmental and Land Use Practice Group, talking about the top five critical OSHA mistakes employers make. Until next time.
And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by Verrill.
Why do we even have employee handbooks? Hi, this is Ben Ford from Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group. For most companies, the employee handbook is something people look at on their first day of work, and then it sits on the shelf forever. Even though they may not be page turners, employee handbooks play a critical role in the management of your business. They are a single repository of all the company policies that relate to that employee, and therefore, they are a resource for both you and your employees. Most importantly, the employee manual helps you set the tone for the company culture. What will you value and what will you not tolerate? And it is for this reason that every few years you should take the manuals off the shelf, dust them off, and review and update them. Got a question about your employee manuals? Call Verrill's Labor and Employment Practice Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by Verrill. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.